from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, SeaWorld has announced it will end orca breeding, Armani agreed to go fur-free in its clothing, and some of the biggest food companies agreed to only buy cage-free eggs. And that all happened in just the month of March. Are we seeing a new animal welfare consciousness among global companies? Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society, thinks so. He calls it the humane economy in his new book that talks about the innovators and enlightened consumers who are transforming the lives of animals. We'll learn more on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum's second hour. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, we look at the status of animal welfare in the agriculture, entertainment, science, and other sectors. Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society of the United States says we have a lot to be optimistic about, and he lays out the reasons in his new book, The Humane Economy, how innovators and enlightened consumers are transforming the lives of animals. Good morning, Wayne Pacelli.
Thanks for having me on, Mina.
Thanks so much for being here. You write in your book that concern for animals is ascendant, that rationalizations for calculated cruelty against animals are getting squeezed into oblivion. So what are the biggest examples of this?
Well, we hear about certain social movements really on the rise, on the move, making gains. And I think, you know, by any objective measure, animal welfare, animal protection, animal rights, whatever you want to call it, is really in that phase of development. You mentioned in your tease of this some of the big brand names in different sectors of the economy that use animals that have made changes. In March, SeaWorld announced it's going to end its breeding of orcas at all of its facilities. On May 1st, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, after 145 years of using elephants, retired them to a Florida facility. Within the last 10 months, we've seen 175 major food retailers, the biggest names you can think of, McDonald's, Burger King, Kroger, Safeway, Walmart, Target, you name the brand. They have made commitments to phase out their purchasing of eggs from factory farms that confine the hens in small wire cages called battery cages. And there are other examples of this progress, and I chronicle it all, as you indicate, in The Humane Economy, where I argue that business needs to align its values with the values of the American public. And that's what's starting to happen. We still have a long way to go, but some really encouraging signs.
Well, and, you know, I was feeling a little skeptical when I was reading about Walmart and McDonald's and Burger King, because it's great that they want to move toward cage-free eggs, right? But when are they planning on doing this? And, you know, often companies will do the most painless thing first. And I'm curious if in some ways they are touting, you know, their use of cage-free eggs maybe to disguise the fact that they could be doing other things that are harmful to animals, like, you know, getting meat from factory farms, for example, still.
Well, again, I think that it's important for us to look critically at any company's announcements in this realm. But for 50, 60 years, we had almost no corporate progress on animal welfare. A lot of people assumed that, well, these animals are going to die anyway. Therefore, you know, what does it matter? I mean, that was the argument. I think things really turned around in California in 2008 when the Humane Society of the United States worked with a big coalition of other organizations to pass Proposition 2. Mm-hmm. It banned the confinement of veal calves in small crates, breeding sows in similarly small crates, and then laying hens jammed into these small wire cages where each hen has less space than the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. A lot of people thought we were going to get run over by agribusiness. It turned out that California voters approved this measure overwhelmingly. 64% of voters favored the measure. At that time, more votes were cast for Prop 2 than any citizen initiative in American history. And it was about farm animals. And I think that really upended conventional thinking about how people view animals, especially animals in the food supply. And I think you can really draw a straight line from that vote to the recent announcements from McDonald's and Walmart and others. And yes, they're phasing these in. They're not doing it immediately. Part of the problem is that for the 300 million laying hens that are producing 90 billion eggs a year, 270 million of them are in these confinement systems now. It's going to take a little while to unwind that, to build new facilities so that the animals at least have the opportunity for some natural movement and are not immobilized in cages that are barely larger than their bodies.
What do you think is driving this moral shift? What do you think was driving the success of Proposition 2? What do you think is driving, you know, consumers to make decisions based on or in part on the treatment of animals?
Well, this is really kind of the central thesis of my book, which is that there are multiple explanations for this. One is we are now embracing the idea that animal cruelty is wrong. I mean, all 50 states have now felony-level penalties for malicious cruelty. South Dakota became the last of the states to make that policy change in 2014. So now it's kind of an accepted value standard that animal cruelty is wrong. Second, there's so much out there in the way of science. There's so much detailed information about animal intelligence and cognition. We can no longer be in denial that these animals think and they feel. They can feel joy and happiness. They can feel fear and terror. And I think that, you know, the third part of this is that we humans are smart enough and creative enough. We have enough ingenuity to figure out new ways to conduct our business without leaving a trail of animal victims in our wake. I mean, if we identify factory farming or cosmetic testing on animals or trophy hunting as a set of moral problems, then shouldn't we be able to figure it out with a combination of corporate action, public policy, just basic behavior changes in our society to move to a new day? You know, it used to be that animals were just thought of as, you know, as targets, as game to be harvested, or, you know, meat, milk, and egg producing machines, or tools for research in a laboratory. I think now we have a much keener understanding of animals. And I think very importantly, we have a sense of growing responsibility within our species to be good to the other creatures who share this planet. I mean, being merciful and being decent, these are not radical notions. These are biblical notions. These are long-standing tenets of a civil society. We just need a much more consistent application of these ideals.
How much of a role do you think social media has played in terms of driving people's consciousness? You bring up the example in your book of Cecil the Lion and how, you know, the reaction on social media contributed to, you know, bigger policy shifts among companies.
Well, it was just a year ago that Cecil the Lion came to be known as the most famous lion. We got to know Cecil after he was killed by an American trophy hunter, a dentist from Minnesota, who was aided by a professional guide. And like a lot of trophy hunters, after they slay one of these remarkable creatures, in this case a very rare lion, only 20,000 African lions remaining in all of Africa, they posed for a picture. And they had this beautiful, grand, slain lion sprawled out in front of them, and they were kneeling on the lion with big grins on their faces. And social media became the pathway for that image to ricochet all over the world. And I think within, you know, hours, the world was outraged about this. And I think this is one of the big problems that we at the Humane Society of the United States confront, is that so many of us are so removed from the actual details of animal cruelty. In this case, a guy traveled 8,000 miles away from the United States to shoot one of these lions. And if we didn't have the picture and we didn't have social media, no one would have known about that. We have similar circumstances with factory farming. You know, these factory farms are these big warehouses. You don't know by looking at it that there are masses of animals, you know, confined so tightly they can barely move. It's only when we send in undercover investigators or journalists penetrate these walls that we can really connect to our food supply. So this is one of the issues that I also grapple with in my book, is that in this era of the information age, where people have cell phones that double as cameras, where we now have so much in the way of social media and internet giving us portals to gather information and to send it around, it's a new day. And I think that cruelty cannot withstand the spotlight. And when we really hold these practices up against our value system, these practices don't do well. And again, when you then add the fact that we can actually make more money in terms of commerce by doing the right thing for animals, which is a big thesis in my book, mm-hmm. that kind of clinches the case.
We're talking with Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society, who says we're seeing a revolution in business that's changing forever how we treat animals and create wealth. His new book is called The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And Wayne Pacelli, so you mentioned economic examples when, you know, being humane actually panned out better economically for companies. Can you just give us a couple of them that you mentioned in your book?
Sure. Well, let me just start with Cecil the lion. I mean, the number of people who are interested in shooting lions and elephants and giraffes is in the thousands, but it's certainly not in the hundreds of thousands and definitely not in the millions. But the number of people interested in taking a picture of lions and giraffes and rhinos and elephants is certainly in the tens or hundreds of millions. And countries like Kenya and Botswana have realized that in terms of their economic progress and generating commerce, it's actually going to be much better for them to protect the wildlife, to stop people from trophy hunting and poaching wildlife, and making the wildlife available to the legions of ecotourists who are happy to just see these animals or take a picture of them and take that image home, rather than kill the animal and then, you know, cut off the head and take the head back to the United States. So Botswana in 2014, as I talk about in The Humane Economy, banned trophy hunting, not just as a moral exercise, but as an economic investment. They realized that an elephant can be watched 100 times or 1,000 times or 5,000 times. An elephant can be shot only once. And that really allows the multiplier effect in terms of economic activity to really develop. And when you have a much larger pool of potential commercial-minded consumers, and you have this opportunity to watch the animals over and over again, that makes the case. And I think what I've argued in the book is that in every sector of the economy, in fashion, in food, in live entertainment, When you have animal cruelty baked into the business model, it's a moral problem, it's a consumer problem, and those companies that continue to engage in that behavior are at risk. I mean, if you upset 10 or 20 or 30% of the public, that's going to be a major risk factor for a company. You can solve that problem by taking the cruelty out of the business model and figuring out a new way to conduct your activities, like Botswana or Kenya, as sovereign governments did. But Walmart is saying, we're going to adhere to the five freedoms of farm animal welfare. McDonald's made announcements to end purchasing over time of pork from operations that confine the sows or eggs from farms that confine the laying hens. I mean, these are incredible changes that 5 or 6 or 7 years ago were almost unimaginable. And yes, it doesn't solve all of the issues for animal protection, and we still have an immense hill to climb at the Humane Society of the United States. But for those people who are concerned about animal cruelty, these are great shots in the arm to show that intentional strategic activity can drive change and that we are becoming a more humane and civilized society when it comes to our treatment of animals.
And you also highlight some of the changes you're seeing in animal testing, not just in cosmetics, but also in research.
Yes. I mean, this is an example where kind of moral intention and recognizing that, yes, it's a moral problem to dip substances into the eye of a rabbit and then to see the effects of that when you don't flush the eye or when you feed chemicals to an animal to the point where half of the subjects used in that experiment die of poisoning. It's called the lethal dose 50 test, where 50% of the animals die. That's a moral problem when animals are being poisoned, when their eyes are being subjected to this substance that's toxic and dangerous and hugely irritating to them. And when you combine that with new technologies that allow us to do risk assessment for cosmetics or chemicals or pesticides, you're like, okay, we can actually test these toxins at different concentration levels. We can do it much faster. We can do it much cheaper. Why would you ever then resort to the 20th century technology and practice of poisoning animals when you can have a 21st century solution that gives us better science, better risk assessment, and leaves no animal victims? This is what is happening. The Congress just passed a bill to reform our laws relating to chemical testing. We have 85,000 chemicals in commercial use in our society. The old way of doing risk assessment was to poison a bunch of animals. Now we have these new 21st century technologies, high throughput tests and biological assays and other tools that allow much more rigorous testing to test many more of these chemicals. And the president signed that bill just a couple of weeks ago to minimize animal testing and to assert that first we've got to use these 21st century technologies. And at the same time, we've had hundreds of companies that are beauty companies that sell cosmetics saying we're not going to test on the animals. And now there's a little symbol on their product saying no animal testing. And consumers are helping to drive that with their purchasing choices. And we hope in just a few years there are no companies that remain that are still testing cosmetics on animals.
We're talking with Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society, about his new book, The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Wayne Pacelli says we're seeing a revolution in business that is changing the way we treat animals. And I'd like to invite you to join the conversation. Do you agree? Where do you think more work needs to be done? You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. You can post them on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Now, Wayne Pacelli, one of the things that I wanted to talk with you about is that, so you talk about the progress that businesses have been making in terms of, you know, treating animal welfare as a key component of the way that they do business, of the food that they want to purchase and so forth. But you also talk about this other side of it, which is how innovation is driving, is helping to decrease, you know, pain and cruelty to animals. And can you just talk a little bit about that other half of it that you think is driving this humane economy?
Yes, very important element of this that innovators and entrepreneurs, recognizing this rising tide of consciousness about animals, are figuring out new ways to produce food, to develop movies, to do testing in the laboratory. And a couple of them are right in the Bay Area. Hampton Creek is the fastest growing food company ever, and it's developed a plant-based substitute for eggs. Now, eggs have been a staple in the human experience for as long as domesticated animals, as long as chickens have been around. And eggs are ubiquitous in our diet. The average American eats 260 eggs, not just the scrambled eggs and the poached eggs where you actually see the egg, but eggs are hidden in muffins and other baked goods and all sorts of products that we consume. And if you can develop a plant-based egg substitute that has the same taste, that has the same binding qualities, that has the same level of protein, but doesn't have the fat and cholesterol, doesn't have any of the animal cruelty, doesn't have the problem of what you do with the male chicks who are no longer useful upon birth to the industry, then isn't this an elegant solution for consumers who, you know, have a habit and a custom of consuming products that are egg-based? And this is why Hampton Creek is growing so fast, and it's now in tens of thousands of supermarkets in the form of its mayonnaise called Just Mayo. They've got other products. They have cookie dough. They are developing a whole raft of products with egg substitutes, and a number of other companies have egg substitutes as well. And I think the principle is that food technologists, scientists are figuring out ways to satisfy our palate, to have the same taste and texture of meat and other animal products, but to kind of extract and eliminate the animal cruelty. I mean, you go to the store and now you can see almond milk, you can see soy milk, you can see rice milk. You've got other products coming out. Now, you know, you don't have to kill a cow to get the milk. The problem is in our industrial food production system, these cows have been engineered to produce so much milk that they've got chronic health problems. The average industrial-style cow is producing 27,000 pounds of milk a year, just one cow. And many of them are going to slaughter at 3, 4, and 5 years of age, even though they can live into their teens, because they're so spent after their body is asked to produce so much milk in such a short period of time. And I think, again, you kind of have the critique of the treatment of the animals in this industrial food production system where we kind of valued productivity and subordinated animal welfare. But now you have these new companies like Hampton Creek and Beyond Meat that are producing products that are very palatable, very healthful, but don't have any of the animal cruelty.
Well, Mike writes, can the speaker address the fact and concern that advertisements such as cage-free eggs do not mean a good humane life for the laying hens? The hens are warehoused indoors in overcrowded, dirty, artificially lit, packed warehouses. I think that only the label pasture-raised means that the hens are allowed to live outdoors in the air and sun. Can your guest speak to false claims in humane advertising? This touches a little bit on what I said earlier. I mean, before we were talking about touting things that you do related to cage-free when you're doing other things that might not be good for animals. But also, cage-free does not necessarily mean they're free, right?
Right. And, you know, it's important that all listeners realize that I'm not saying that everything is solved here. I'm saying that we're making incredible progress, that some of the things that persisted for decades that were almost politically untouchable and that big corporations just kept on doing in terms of purchasing animal products from factory farms, that is changing, and that is a very hopeful development. But, you know, you go into the marketplace, and eggs are actually one of the best labeled of all the products. If you're getting meat, you're not getting much information on the package about where the animal came from and what the conditions were. If you go to the egg case, if you have conventional eggs, they're almost certainly coming from a battery cage operation, which is not only, you know, a severe problem from an animal welfare perspective, but they're, in our view, food safety concerns as well. Cage-free does not mean free-range. You will now see in the marketplace different designations which really speak to different levels of animal welfare. Cage-free literally means they're not in a cage. They still can be in a warehouse, but it doesn't mean they're outside. Pasture-raised essentially means that, yes, they're outside. And for those consumers who want to eat eggs and who want to see animals engaging in normal, natural behaviors, feeling grass underneath their feet or sunlight on their backs, that is the set of products you want to purchase. So, again, I think we need to be discerning consumers and really ask what the backstory is. And, you can get information on our website at humanesociety.org about what all of these different labels mean.
Well,
and we're certainly not saying that cage-free equals cruelty-free.
And just as a follow-up to Mike's question, what are some of the worst culprits in terms of false claims in humane advertising?
Well, there have been a number of them. We actually just had an announcement with Purdue, which doesn't raise chickens for eggs. It raises them for meat. Previously, we had sued Purdue for the charge of putting humanely raised on the chicken that was in the marketplace. And they were also making the claim that it was cage-free. This was deceptive because cage-free is the standard for broiler birds because the birds would get bruises on them. And it sounds like we're going to a break, but I think that what's happening is the public is now starting to focus on these issues.
We'll have more with Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society, after the break. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 866-733-6786, email us at forum@kqed.org, or post your questions on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. There's more. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about animal welfare with Wayne Pacelli. He is president of the Humane Society, and he writes about how Ringling Brothers retired its circus elephants, SeaWorld will stop breeding orcas, and Walmart is shifting towards cage-free eggs. Pacelli says these are examples of a humane economy taking shape that's being driven by conscious consumers. And do you agree? Are you convinced? Are you not? Let us know why. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to Joanne in San Francisco. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thank you. I love Forum, and your guest, thank you. You're an incredible spokesperson. But I have a couple questions. My first is, I do buy free-range, organic. My family does. My mom does. But I've talked to a couple friends, and what they say, and it's very valid, they say, you know, I make minimum wage, and I'm raising a child. Have you seen the price differential between inexpensive eggs and pasture-raised eggs? And it's a valid point, so that's one thing. and pasturage are even more expensive than when it says cage-free. And the second thing is, about a month ago, we were in, I think it was Sonoma, and we had to stop, and there were some baby cows, and they were in, they were outside, but in tight little pens, and their head was in a plastic, through a plastic thing, where it looked like they could just reach down to eat their food and then lift their head. And I thought, at least I'm assuming, I didn't ask the woman, but I'm assuming those were veal cows. And I thought that kind of immobility was illegal. Anyway, those are my two questions, and thank you so much.
Joanne, thank you. Wayne Baselli, yes, you addressed both of these. Feel free to take one of those first. You want to take, you know, the issue with crates and that effect on animals and what's happening right now with that, and also the broader question about affordability of these products that are more humanely raised.
Sure. Let me start with the affordability issue. I mean, overall, I'll say that, you know, 45 years ago, Frances Moore LePay, the writer, wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet, and she said that animals are protein factories in reverse, that they take enormous inputs of grains and other plant foods to produce a small amount of meat, eggs, or milk. So if we're thinking just about the kind of underlying costs, it's much cheaper, should be much cheaper to eat more plant-based foods than meat. This is why meat has always been, you know, pretty expensive. The issue with factory farming in the last 60 years is we drove down that cost by cutting corners, by putting the animals in these warehouses and in these crates, and we've been giving them hormones and substances like ractopamine to accelerate their growth. We manipulated their genetics. The problem with the cost equation is that we're paying one fairly low price at the cash register, but there are all of these externalities. There are these other social costs and economic costs that are passed on to us in other ways. Healthcare costs, environmental costs because of all the manure. Obviously, the animal cruelty costs are almost incalculable. So part of the rationale for my book is to do a proper accounting of what's going on with animals. And this factory farming system, while it may be cheap at the cash register, has enormous costs that are being paid for by our government, which means by taxpayers. There are other costs that are being passed on to homeowners. When one of these factory farms is not too far from your home, property values drop because you can't even go outside. It smells so bad. So when it comes to the different costs for the different types of eggs, yes, to give the animals more space will cost a little bit more. But the differential between conventional cage production and conventional cage-free production is de minimis, which is why the companies that are low-cost sellers of food, like Walmart and McDonald's, have embraced it. They did the economic analysis. Now, if you want to go to pasture-raised, you're going to pay more. But how much do we pay for a coffee at Starbucks? I mean, we've got to think about the cost to the animals. And if we pay a little bit more in order to give the animals a better life, that's worth it.
Will having more companies get involved and agree to only purchase from, you know, sellers who are providing cage-free environments for their animals, will that help bring down the cost?
Yes, absolutely. When that becomes the conventional system, the price differential between what we're seeing now in the marketplace and what we're seeing for cage-free is going to shrink. Right now, a lot of these same companies, these big food retailers, are essentially getting a markup from the consumers. They're marking up the product because they know that many consumers looking for cage-free will pay more. But the underlying production costs are, according to one economist in the egg industry, about a penny higher per egg for cage-free versus the conventional cage confinement. So it'd be about 12 cents a dozen as the actual underlying cost. Now, if the supermarket marks it up 50 cents or a dollar, that's more profit for the grocer or the food retailer, but it doesn't really reflect the underlying cost.
Well, how do you know that's not what the companies will do?
Well, I think that the marketplace in that case is going to take over. Right now, they are trading on this incredible growing sympathy that we have for animals, and more people are choosing cage-free and pasture-raised. But I think, again, with more transparency, when that becomes the standard, a lot of the grocers realize that eggs have been a staple, a core commodity, and they do want people to come in and get eggs, and then they're going to shop for other products. So it's actually in their interest not to inflate the prices, to have the conventional eggs and hopefully they're going to come from cage-free hens everywhere very soon, that's going to be a lure for consumers, so they're going to keep the price at a reasonable level.
Well, a listener asks, in 2007, after lots of pet food recalls, new businesses sprang up providing various organic, wheat-free, raw alternatives to corporate-owned pet food companies. Consumers presumed the small companies' motives were less suspect than the conglomerates, who proved willing to make dangerous compromises in the absence of regulatory oversight. In the last 4 years, companies like Mars and Nestle Purina have bought up many of these small companies, leaving the brands untouched, but not necessarily the products. What are consumers getting for their money? What's really changed after the great pet food recall of 2007?
Well, I think this is one area and one domain of commercial activity that really needs more scrutiny. You know, we at the Humane Society of the United States have been putting a lot of focus on factory farming and the rearing of animals for meat, milk, and eggs for human consumption. Obviously, that same enterprise is pushing out animal products for pet food as well. And of course, there's a whole fish component to the pet food industry. But there are many, many questions about this. And we're now starting to see some of the big companies making big changes in the realm of feeding people. I'm not sure we're seeing that happening yet in terms of animal welfare declarations from the big pet food companies. And I think we're going to start to be more concerned for the very same reasons that we're concerned about the animals in the human food chain. We should be concerned about the animals in the pet food chain. There are also big health-related issues. I mean, many dogs and cats are dying too young from cancers and other diseases that may be related to the consumption activities. I know that my animals at home, we pay attention to what we're buying. Sometimes we make food for our animals, and I think this is going to be a big subject. You know, when I talk about the humane economy, I'm not saying it's arrived in every domain. This is one area where we're still waiting for more formation of the humane economy when it comes to pet food.
And in terms of the Humane Society's efforts, what is the next big frontier in terms of the issues that you're trying to address? Is it factory farms?
Well, factory farms, we've made a lot of progress. I mean, we're ending the era of extreme confinement of veal calves, breeding sows, and laying hens. That's an immense amount of progress on an issue that 10 years ago was almost nowhere. By 2017, we're also seeing the end of tail docking of dairy cows. And, you know, I argue in the book that California has become a big incubator of the humane economy, that so many trends on animal welfare started in California. California was the first state to ban tail docking of dairy cows, where they literally cut off a portion of the cow's tail, the living tissue, not just the hair at the end of the tail, but the actual, sensory part of the tail. And several other states followed, and now the National Milk Producers Federation has said that by 2017, tail docking should end everywhere in the United States. So, yes, I mean, we still have other areas of factory farming. The big issue is broiler birds, so the chickens raised for meat. They're growing so fast that many of them can't even walk. They're so over-muscled. They're so fat. They're growing at a pace, if we grew as fast as the average factory farm broiler chicken grows, we would, at 2 years of age, weigh 350 or 400 pounds. That's how fast these chickens are growing. They're slaughtered at 6 weeks. So Purdue, just last Monday, made an announcement that said they're going to look at this fast growth issue. They're going to allow their birds to have access to some sunlight. They're going to support a shift away from the inhumane slaughter practices now, where they shackle the birds on these hooks and hang them upside down, drag them through an electrified water bath, and then slice their neck with a neck slicer. And they're going to move to what's called controlled atmosphere killing, where they put them in a chamber with inert gases, and then the birds die that way, which is much less inhumane for them. So factory farming, but we've got lots of issues. We're fighting the dog meat trade in China and Vietnam and South Korea. In South Korea, there are 17,000 dog meat farms. We actually brought some of the animals to the San Francisco SPCA that we rescued from South Korea and other shelters in the Bay Area. We've got lots of issues with horse slaughter. We still have animal testing issues to address. We've got you know, continuing challenges in rooting out dogfighting and cockfighting. So our work is by no means done, but what we're seeing is a tipping point where the public is really exhibiting less tolerance for animal cruelty and wants to see alternative commercial activities.
How do you decide when to tout a company's humane efforts, right? I mean, you know, when do you decide that it's, like, for the Purdue example, when did you decide that that was the right time to do it without, you know, worrying about the company maybe getting complacent or consumers being misled that this company is now a totally humane company?
Well, again, we don't say the company's totally humane. We say that these are signs of progress. And when we state an objective, you know, say on the Walmart case, the McDonald's case, when we say, listen, we need to stop keeping hens in these confinement cages where they're immobilized and you need to move toward cage-free, when a company says, okay, we're going to do that, even if it's a phase-out of 5 years or 10 years, we want to applaud that because in the humane economy, companies that do the right thing have to be recognized. They have to be supported. If they're just going to be bashed by us, no matter what they do, what incentive is there for them to change their behavior? When it comes to Purdue, I mean, this came after many months of discussion with Purdue. We were talking to them. We said, you know, you've got to address the wide range of issues. The inhumane slaughter is a huge problem. 9 billion chickens slaughtered for food, and the vast, vast majority of them, 99% plus, are with this old-style shackling system and the neck slicer. When they say we're going to move toward controlled atmosphere killing and they're the first of the big chicken producers to do this, I mean, that is a cause for celebration. It doesn't mean that all the issues are solved, but this is a first mover, and that really warrants credit from my perspective. You know, when McDonald's became of the biggest of the companies, was a first mover on the cage-free issue, 175 other companies followed. That is incredible, and I hope that same thing happens within the broiler chicken industry where the other big companies, Pilgrim's Pride and Tyson's and others, say, okay, we now have to make similar animal welfare declarations. That's the competition that drives the humane economy. It used to be a race to the bottom where you can do anything you want to animals. Now it's going to be a race upward. Where it's going to end, I'm not sure. But what's happening is we're seeing more humane standards. And then, as you noted earlier in our show, we're seeing innovation, which is allowing us to have plant-based products that mimic the taste and texture of those animal products that take the animals out of the equation entirely.
You're vegan, is that right?
I am, yes.
And do you see a humane economy as involving meat at all? You know, in the future, is your, you know, ultimate goal to see that we move away from animals as food generally?
Well, you know, I've been vegan for a long time. I made the decision more than 30 years ago that that was the right lifestyle choice for me. And we are big advocates of reducing our meat consumption for the sake of the animals. More than 9 billion animals are raised every year. If we just went meatless even one day a week, we have a campaign called Meatless Mondays. Many major school systems like Los Angeles and Houston and Detroit have adopted Meatless Monday programs. If we did that as a nation, if all 320 million Americans adhered to that, we would save 1.5 billion animals a year. So we recognize that meat and other animal products have been part of the human diet for a long time. That's not going to change overnight, even if many people want to will that. We want to take incremental steps to alleviate the worst, most acute forms of suffering for animals, and we want to remind people about the benefits of more of a plant-based diet. More plant-based foods, or if you want to go all the way, an entirely plant-based diet, it's better for you, it's better for animals, it's better for the environment. And, you know, I don't say that we as an organization, you know, are going to be able to achieve that or even push that aim. We want to work with every consumer. If you're the average American eating 210 pounds of meat a year, if you can even reduce to 180 pounds or 150 pounds or cut it by half, what enormous progress that is for you as an individual and for animals. And I want to celebrate that. You know, we don't want to make, you know, perfection the enemy of the good. Progress, not perfection, is our metric at the Humane Society. And that's why, frankly, we celebrate these companies who, you know, aren't engaging in perfect behavior in the marketplace, but they're improving. They're taking tangible good steps to make the world better, and we want to celebrate that.
Well, Josie asked, and this may be a similar answer, but she says, I'm vegan. One obstacle I come up against is that no matter how gently and sensitively I talk about these issues with people, people feel criticized, shamed, or attacked, hence the stereotype of the angry vegan. Just wondering if your guest could speak to how to talk with others about these issues, what has worked, how can we protect the animal activist movement from that negative stereotype of being attacking and negative?
Well, this is a great question, and obviously it's something that all of us think about. Wherever you are on either side of that equation, you know, these are deeply personal issues. What we eat, the food that we put into our body, you know, is kind of laden with moral judgments, even if we're not stating things in a judgmental way. And, you know, what we try to do at the Humane Society is remind people that we as a society reject cruelty to animals and that we should actually logically apply those principles. It doesn't just apply to dogs or horses and cats. It should apply to all animals. And I think when we have more options and it's much easier for people to do these things, then we'll see more acceptance and a broadening of participation in eating of more plant-based foods. But, you know, I've never really been one for hectoring people. I've never been one for shaming them. I think that stating the case, and the case for eating a more plant-based diet is overwhelming. From an animal cruelty perspective, when you think of the factory farms, from a waste management perspective, you know, 320 million Americans produce an enormous amount of waste. That waste is treated. You know, we denude it of its toxic properties in septic systems and waste treatment facilities. For the 9 billion animals that are producing waste, we're not treating any of that. It's going into the environment. We're overusing antibiotics and hormones on these factory farms at risk of public health and our personal health. And I think that the case is extraordinary. So I'm an advocate of sharing the information and letting that seep in. And I hope people of conscience will act in a way that is intentional.
We're talking with Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society, about his new book, The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. A listener asks, is this the same Humane Society that still has kill shelters for dogs and cats? What is the Humane Society's position on euthanizing animals?
Well, the Humane Society of the United States is one nonprofit organization. We actually have affiliates. We have Humane Society International, and we've got a 501c4 called the Humane Society Legislative Fund and a number of other affiliates. But we don't run all of the local humane organizations, whether they're dog and cat shelters or big cat rescues or wildlife rehab centers. There are thousands of other animal organizations. We don't conduct euthanasia of dogs and cats at the Humane Society. We do have enormously robust animal rescue programs, whether it's raiding a puppy mill in Arkansas or an animal hoarding operation in North Carolina, or helping folks in urban communities or the most rural communities deal with treating their pets and medicating them and vaccinating them. We do all of these things. But there is a roiling debate in society about the euthanasia of healthy dogs and cats. The good news, and I talk about this in my book, is that companies like Petco and PetSmart, which I credit with being part of the humane economy, opened their doors in the 1990s to rescues and shelters. Rather than selling dogs from puppy mills at Petco and PetSmart, they decided they were going to throw open their stores to these homeless animals. And since then, 11 million dogs and cats have been adopted through Petco and PetSmart facilities. This is an example of the humane economy. And it's a way that the shelters are moving homeless animals and reducing euthanasia. No shelter should ever want to euthanize a healthy and treatable animal. Everyone in our field should be pressing for the day that zero animals are euthanized. The issue is not enough people are adopting. Not enough spaying and neutering is occurring, and we're trying to promote adoption and to offer low-cost spay and neuter surgeries for people so that we can crack the code. But the solution rests with all of us. When I hear someone talking about a kill shelter, you know, I actually recoil a little bit because no shelter should ever want to kill animals. But we all need to be part of the community solution to make sure that all of those homeless dogs and cats get adopted.
Have you been reading the reports that the pressure to have a no-kill shelter has actually unleashed suffering on animals in terms of overcrowding, concerns about there being enough oversight at these shelters?
There have been some cases of that, and I don't think they've been enormously numerous. We've actually done some investigations of a couple of these operations, and, you know, you can have bad management of any kind of shelter, whether it's where there's no euthanasia occurring of healthy and treatable animals, or euthanasia of animals who are healthy and treatable. You know, I think the goal is for us to eliminate this, and shelters should never have become, you know, places where the public associated them with killing, that somehow they're the ones that are going to dispose of this societal problem of not enough adoption. You know, in our nation, and I talk about this in my book, we have 10,000 puppy mills churning out 2 to 4 million dogs for the pet trade at the very time that we have 3,500 brick-and-mortar shelters desperately trying to adopt out animals. And this is one of those examples, again, of how the public is so deeply disassociated from the actual backstory of the animals, that we don't see what goes on in the puppy mill in Missouri or Oklahoma. You see a cute little puppy at a pet store, and you want to rescue that animal because you feel pity or sympathy for them. Well, you're actually contributing to the commerce that supports the puppy mills. The first response should be to go to a shelter or rescue group and adopt the animals. And, of course, the shelters and the rescue groups need to continue to do better at marketing the animals. And this is what I talk about in the book. One great innovation in our field was PetFinder.com allowed shelters and rescues to put pictures and background on the animals on the website, because you go to the shelter and there may not be the types of dogs that consumers want, but you go to Pet Finder, you can get any kind of dog you want. And it really opens up the broader community of homeless animals. So we no longer have the excuse that, hey, I want this kind of dog and I can't get that through a shelter, therefore I'm going to go to a pet store and get a puppy mill dog. We don't have that problem anymore because Pet Finder has solved it.
All right. Well, let's go to Ron in Hamilton. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Some good points have been brought up. I'm focusing on, with a group of people on a global level, what's in it? What's in our food, of course, what's in our pets, and what is in the food that represents the animal field?
So you're concerned about labeling, you mean, in terms of animals?
Well, more than labeling, no. I'm concerned about regulations that are put out by government that don't allow an amount of a toxic substance in the product, but do not consider what is in the product below the regulatory level, which is bioaccumulative in humans and animals and has disease causation. We're basically passing on disease causation, toxic substances, to the foods we eat, even though we have regulations, but regulations seem to favor industry rather than human health.
Ron, thanks. Wayne Pasley, do you have a response?
Sure. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the things we want to see at the Humane Society of the United States is more transparency. We want more labeling. We want consumers to have more information. When they have more information, they make better decisions. When you're talking about some of these chemicals, this is why we were a big booster of reforming our federal Toxic Substances Control Act, which is the governing statute regulating chemicals. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, just what's labeled. We're talking about, we were not doing basic research to figure out whether these chemicals should be in the environment at all. You know, since 1976, only 5 chemicals were taken out of the commercial market out of 85,000. Now, there's no way that there weren't more dangerous chemicals in circulation, but our regulatory structure was not built in a way to sift them out, and that needs to change. You know, we're generally bigger advocates of labeling. When it comes to animal welfare, Whole Foods has the most developed program of labeling of animal products, back to the issue of humane treatment, not the toxics issue, which is dealt with more by the organic label, which is an important one and is also now under review. But Whole Foods has a 1 to 5+ step-based rating program. So if you go and get chicken or turkey or beef, you can look at the product and it's labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 5+. Now, for the vegans and vegetarians, they may not be the least bit interested in this, but for people who are eating animal products, you can get higher welfare products, which actually are audited programs where there is an auditor who goes to the farm and assures that the animals are treated in a certain way. and you don't get that sort of treatment and you don't have that step-based program at any of the other major grocery stores. That program needs to really be adopted broadly in society. All food retailers should adopt, we think, this step-based rating program to give consumers more of the backstory about how the animals are treated on the farm.
Well, you know, just a couple of final quick questions. One listener writes, I was in Kenya and Tanzania last year and learned there are two types of poaching, shooting an elephant for the tusks or a local shooting a zebra with a bow and arrow for food. Local African people need to have access to hunting food rather than keeping all the zebra and wildebeest in protective game preserves for the enjoyment of tourists. There needs to be a balance. Does trade-offs come up for you very much? Like, how do you balance that?
Well, sure, but let me say that, you know, conservationists in Africa and throughout the world are deeply concerned about what's called the bushmeat trade, that people are killing hundreds and hundreds of millions of African animals for meat. It's unsustainable. It's a threat to these communities and ecotourism. And if you're going to be killing animals for food, it must be part of some regulated program. It can't be just people willy-nilly, you know, killing chimpanzees and zebras and giraffes and other creatures, which is what's been happening. The bushmeat trade is a huge threat to African wildlife. Of course, the global poaching activities where people are killing elephants for their ivory and rhinos for their horns, also a big thing. California passed legislation to stop the trade in those parts recently.
So in the last minute we have, Michael just wants to know if you can summarize the best way the public can make the strongest impact on shaping the humane future of animals. One thing, Wayne Pacelli.
Vote for animal protection with your dollars in the marketplace.
Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society. His new book is The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Thanks for being with us, Wayne Pacelli.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.